Hello, this is Brian Reynolds, volunteer with the San Luis Obispo County Library for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by Dr. Bridget Queenan, Associate Director of University of California, Santa Barbara Brain Initiative. Welcome.
Hi, Brian. I'm glad to be here.
Yes, this is a very special day for me. My background, not only in librarianship, but in psychology and including the cognitive side of it, I can't wait to get into the meat of this. Your topic today will be the activities of the Brain Initiative at UCSB, broadly speaking, and we're going to talk about some of the details and how that works and some of the hopes and goals. But what I'd like to do first is start a little bit about you personally, like where you were born and grew up, and in particular, how you gravitated to this field of research.
Great. So I grew up in New York State, but I grew up as a fan of all of the Philadelphia sports teams, which was a bit insulating. And so I was actually very, very into hockey growing up. I was very into the Philadelphia Flyers. And one of the problems was the players that I liked kept getting head injuries and kept getting concussions. And one of the things that became very apparent, even, you know, as a kid, as a middle schooler, was when the players that I liked broke their legs, sure, the orthopedic surgeons come in and fix it. When they collapse their lungs, cardiothoracic surgeons come in and fix it. When they did something to their head, not only were there no effective interventions to kind of help them get over the concussion, but even at the time in the 90s, there was this kind of prevalent belief that it was all in their head, that this wasn't actually a legitimate condition, that they were kind of faking it and they were soft. And so in the early 90s, you started to have players like Pat LaFontaine, who was on the Rangers, start advocating for, you know, head injury is a real thing, concussions are a real thing, and it's really taken, you know, the last 20 years to get that to the forefront. But that's really what had started gotten me interested in brains to begin with. But I really didn't understand what neuroscience was. The idea of becoming a neuroscientist was insane. I mean, I wouldn't have become an experimental particle physicist. I mean, that just sounded like some crazy thing that normal people couldn't do. And so it took me a number of years to actually get to neuroscience. I went through different types of science that seemed more accessible. I did tumor biology for a number of years because I was like, yeah, I can understand tumors. This is a thing that I could try and solve.
Was this after you got through with your education and you're working, or in the middle of that?
I worked at a pharmaceutical company for 3 years in high school, working on blood vessel growth for tumors. When I was at Harvard, I worked in cancer biology labs. That seemed like a very concrete problem of, yes, we got to stop these cells from growing. And that kind of was something I could grasp. I then kind of got to a point where I was like, this isn't really what I want to do. I don't know what's missing. And it was actually, I had just gotten a job where I was editing textbooks for medical students. And my first assignment was a neuroanatomy book. And I just started looking at the pictures and was just amazed at the structure and how the nervous system could be wired up and have all these diverse functions. And it was the first time where I was looking at parts of brains, and basically it's like if you're starting to read a language, you know, at first it looks like nonsense, but then you look and you look and you look and you see the components and you start to see patterns. And one day I was looking at this picture of a brain and I was like, I can read this, you know, I can see what this picture is saying. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to graduate school. I'm going to become a neuroscientist. That's it. Looking back.
that is so neat. Is it safe to say that of all the organs in the body, the brain is the most mysterious?
The brain is pretty mysterious. I'm trying to think if there's anyone that has, if there's any of the other organs that are in contention. I'm going to say the brain's most mysterious because that'll keep me in business the longest.
Well, I was just thinking there's certain optical illusions in paintings where you look at a man in a mirror who sees himself in a mirror, and of course I'm seeing your brain looking at the other brain in the textbook or wherever it was and communing. So that's a kind of a creepy thing.
It falls apart.
the I'd like to have you describe in brief terms sort of the vision of the Brain Initiative, like the work will create a better world for patients and customers, whatever. And then some of your main goals, like two or three goals. So what is the vision? What kind of world would you like this Brain Initiative to help create, in brief?
A better one. So I think the goal for me and for us with the Brain Initiative is to say there's always this inherent tension in how we conduct science. So in order to figure out how the world works, we as scientists have agreed we're going to use certain tools to look at the world and quantify the world and then mathematically model it and predict it and then try and do useful things. And so intellectually, we're saying, yes, we just want to understand everything all the time. We got to solve all the world's problems. Practically, there's always a limitation, which is we use physical tools to extract information from the world, right? We use microscopes, or we use electrodes, or we use telescopes, or, you know, we have to have ways of looking at the world and quantifying it. And so sometimes we run up against these barriers where we say there is a point past which we cannot actually see what's going on, and we certainly can't quantify it, and then we're not going to be able to understand it, and we're not going to be able to figure it out. So you cannot solve problems that you cannot see. And so there has to be, while science is trying to push forward, there also has to be a big tech development push concurrently to say, can we make better ways of seeing things? And so right now, there's a lot of really exciting neuroscience going on, but we also have to say, what are better and better ways that we can look at the brain and see what it's doing and then try and decode it? And we can't just stay within the realm of, well, these are the tools that we have, this is what we can see, that's it. We're not going to, we want to keep pushing the technical ability to see brains and understand them outward. And so that's hard because that's not the same thing as running an experiment. That's a big engineering challenge.
Sure,
and
sure.
So one of the things that's great about our Brain Initiative is, you know, this is a campus that is extremely strong in physics and engineering, and we have a lot of people who have all of these amazing ways of interacting with the world and quantifying it and predicting it and modeling it. And so a lot of what I do is to say who on campus has some amazing thing that we are not yet using to help see, understand, and fix brains. And because we have this amazing, open, collaborative campus, you know, I can go into people's offices and talk to them about their research and say, you know, you have exactly the thing that we need to solve this problem. And basically every time they'll say, yeah, if I can help understand and fix brains, I will do it.
That's so interesting because I know there's reputations of scholars and academics of a little bit on the egotistical side or not necessarily cooperative. Like, I've published more articles than you, but I guess you've gotten a pretty high level of cooperation there.
Yeah, it's actually been fantastic. I mean, when I started on this campus, I would just, you know, cold call people, just send them an email, say, hey, you know, can we get a coffee? Can we go for a walk? And just everyone immediately gave me an hour, talked about their research, what they have done, what they dream of doing, and we just immediately got to brainstorming and, yep, let's hang out and let's have lunch, and you have to meet this person, and you got to work with them on this, and this person has this microscope, and this person knows how to model that. And so it just, because people were not protective of their kind of jurisdiction, because they were open and just because, I mean, they just want to solve cool problems that make the world better. It's just a very easy sell when you go into someone's office and say, you've got the thing that could maybe help me unlock the secret of how brains work and how they get sick. Just no one's going to turn that down.
That's pretty sweet. You know, as a public employee myself for years, there's an old saying that budgets and funding are married to policy and politics. In other words, wherever and from whomever you get your money, there's always, almost always, strings attached and directions. So the broad question for you now is, where does your money, your funding come from, and does it allow you to do policy-wise and quantity-wise the kinds of things you feel need to be done?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things. We're very lucky right now that Congress has actually remained very supportive of scientific research, and they're very supportive of scientific research about the mind and brain. So that's been fantastic that neuroscience and neuroengineering are a topic that have broad bipartisan support. You know, the Department of Defense is very interested in understanding how brains work and how can they get rid of PTSD and a lot of the problems with depression that their veterans incur. So fortunately, we are living in a time when Congress feels that it's very important to invest in science and particularly to invest in brain research. Because part of the thing is, so if you look over the last 100 years, I mean, the things that afflict us are so different now from what they were 100 years ago. And that is because of the progress that has been made. So 100 years ago, I mean, just not getting an infectious disease, tuberculosis, typhoid, one of these things, I mean, those were the major killers, right?
Right. There are no antibiotics.
What was that?
No antibiotics 100 years ago.
No, no, exactly. And so then antibiotics and sanitation, you know, all these public health policies of, like, let's make sure the water is clean and people have food and, you know, wash their hands. I mean, all of these things just eradicated a class of plagues that people couldn't even imagine us getting rid of. But, you know, science just said, yeah, we're not doing smallpox anymore.
Right.
We're not doing cholera anymore. We can solve this. Scientific discoveries and then public policy, public health interventions. And so then you had this next wave of, okay, we're not dying early of infectious disease, but then you had some of these kind of cardiovascular disease, stroke, you know, heart disease sort of things really came to the fore. And while those are not completely solved, there has been a ton of headway on, you know, what can we do in terms of diet, in terms of exercise, in terms of surgeries, in terms of drugs, to really limit that problem. And so then, because of all the progress there, we've now gotten to the point where it's now the diseases of the mind and brain that are becoming the big, big financial and emotional and medical burdens on the society. So everyone knows someone who they and their families are just being devastated by Alzheimer's or by Parkinson's or by schizophrenia or just, you know, manic depression. So, you know, we have to just keep moving forward and saying the goal is for everyone in the society to have the happiest and healthiest and best life possible. And yeah, we can do a lot of these efforts in parallel, but we need to have kind of short, medium, and long-term solutions in place. And, and investing in science and technology is consistently the best long-term solution.
Yeah, I think strategically, I know that's an important thing, and it's hard to do in a world that's as busy as ours. I recently saw a video about addiction and how it is primarily a physiological reaction in the brain, in different parts of the brain, to pleasure. And it is emphatically, when you get hooked on something, whatever it might be, it is emphatically a physical condition that has physical characteristics and remedies. It is not a moral lapse or a you know, failure of judgment. And if that's true, it means the way we have handled addiction in the judicial arena or prisons is completely upside down.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, one of the things, it's not ready for prime time yet, but one of the things that I think will be completely transformative is, so our justice system basically has the sentencing is based on kind of a numerator and a denominator, which are what was the crime that you committed, and what was your intention or capacity to plan out that crime, right?
Right.
And we can, I mean, sometimes it's not the best, but in terms of the crime that was committed, it's like, this person is dead, and now we can kind of go and try and figure out who was responsible physically for that. But in terms of how are we assessing, you know, was this person in their right mind? Was this kind of a justifiable response in terms of these stand your ground things. You know, was this person actually really threatened? Did they actually perceive that this person was going to kill them? You know, we don't have, I mean, those are just judgments based on a jury kind of says, you know, I think that that person is telling the truth or isn't. And so if we could actually quantify these things to say, you know, this person is a good person with a very serious rage problem,
right.
That would be a completely, it's not to say that you would have to let them walk free. You might have to say, look, you know, we've got a really serious problem here. When you're confronted with a normal situation, you perceive yourself to be under attack and you have this volcanic response and we can't have you doing that. But the strategy that you would employ to try and rehabilitate that person or how you would have them engage with the society would be so, so different, right? You would just say, okay, you know, maybe we can't have you out in this context, but you can be a very useful member of the society. We just got to, like, quarantine you a little bit. But there's nothing morally wrong with you. This is an emotional response from a early life trauma or a head injury or something like that. So, yeah, I think as much as possible, removing any of the fake, completely unscientifically justified moral nonsense from these conversations will just really help us match people to the best treatments and interventions and say that the purpose of the justice system is not to incarcerate everyone. It's to get everyone in a sustainable situation in the society.
Of course. I'd like to remind everyone that this is Brian Reynolds, volunteer with the San Luis Obispo County Library for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Today, we are joined by Dr. Bridget Queenan, Associate Director of the University of California at Santa Barbara Brain Initiative. Bridget, I'd like to switch to the more on the technical side. Could you describe, when we're studying the brain, you guys are studying the brain in real time, the brain in action. In plain English, how does that happen and what does that mean so everyone can understand that better?
Okay. So as you probably know or suspect, heads and brains are not see-through. So we can't just look inside your head and see what it's doing. And so there has been, over the last couple hundred years, the default way of looking at brain activity is to try and measure its electrical activity. So if I put a piece of metal near or in your head, your cells are firing, they are spiking, they're crackling, so it sounds like kind of static over the radio because they're all kind of firing these electrical signals. And so that's been dominated, you know, neuroscience for basically 200 years, is how do we electrically interact with brains. Then there was a huge explosion in the late 80s, early 90s of functional MRI. So this was a way of looking at where is the oxygen going in your brain, and that when oxygen is there or not there, the magnetic properties of the blood are different, and we could put you in a scanner and say, hey, this area no longer has oxygen, which means those cells are probably really active. So functional MRI was the first time where you could say, we can actually look inside the head of a person while they're thinking. We don't have to try and put some metal in there, which is creepy and horrible. We can just put them in a scanner, and we can see what they're thinking, and we can see these different areas. So that was fantastic and kind of launched this whole new era of cognitive neuroimaging.
So great. Just to make that clear, an MRI, when I think of that, I think of it like an X-ray looks at bones, and an MRI typically at soft tissue, but this is looking at the presence of a particular gas, in this case,
yeah,
oxygen?
Yeah, so functional MRI overlays two types of things. So it's using the same technology as magnetic resonance imaging, standard MRIs, which are basically saying, basically MRI, what it does is a lot of the tissues in your body, kind of water, fats, bone, they contain protons, you know, hydrogen. And if you put them in a magnetic field, they'll kind of all align themselves. And then if you mess with that magnetic field very briefly, so basically they're like little soldiers that will all stand up straight. But based on whether they're in water or in fat or in bone, when you say at ease, they behave differently.
Right.
And so that's how you get a MRI, is that they relax at different speeds, and then you can figure out, oh, is this a proton that was in water, in fat, in bone? What is it doing? So then what you do is then on top of that, so functional MRI superimposes another technique, which is to say in a magnetic field, you know, your blood has, we need iron in our blood. Why? Iron helps us move oxygen to our cells, and oxygen, like the rest of us, is what our cells use to breathe. So when you are watching, you can watch in a magnetic field oxygen delivering, iron-containing cells deliver oxygen to certain parts of the brain. And by then looking and saying, hey, there used to be a whole bunch of oxygen here and now there isn't, you can say, wow, that area must be really active, that it just suddenly sucked up all that oxygen.
Huh.
So, yes, it's pretty cool.
So is
pretty
it,
cool.
Is it, this is probably not an adequate term, but are you, in a sense, mapping the brain?
Yeah, well, so what's really nice about that technique is you're not kind of mapping it in a static sense of, you know, if you were just drawing a map of the campus, it'd be like, okay, this building is here, this building is here, this building is here. With functional MRI, you can take your physical map of the campus, and then you could also say, depending on the time of day or the activity, this is where people and things are happening, right? So you can take the physical MRI map, and you can superimpose this dynamic functional pattern of activity on top of it, and then you get a completely different understanding of, you know, what's going on where, and you can start to try and guess why, where you're like, oh, there's probably graduation today. Normally, there's not all those people on that field.
Right.
And so that's what functional MRI enabled was we didn't have to look at just what the physical map of the brain was. We could watch it doing things in real time, and that was pretty amazing. So then it's like, okay, well, if that was great, let's keep going. Let's keep trying to figure out other ways of looking at brains. And so recently there's been another really cool explosion where people have figured out, so again, if I shine light on your skull or on your brain, I can't see through, right? Because the photons, they come in and they bounce off or they get absorbed, but they're not going through. And so I can't just use regular light to see through your head. But I can use longer wavelengths of light. So visible light isn't going to go through your head, or light that's visible to humans isn't going to go through your head and isn't going to go through your brain. But infrared light, which has longer wavelengths, is going to go through. Or what you can try and do is you can say the likelihood of one photon getting to this location is very low. It's going to scatter. But you can devise ways of saying, can we get two photons to be coincident in the same time and place? And then we'll actually know that this is kind of a reliable optical signal. So two-photon microscopy has really revolutionized a lot of fields, including neuroscience. And so one of the things that we're very excited about is our campus specialty, or at least one of the major ones, is in photonics. So UCSB does a lot of the really high-end research and manufacturing to say, how do you make, devices, silicon-based electrical devices that interface with photons? That's the basis of our telecom industry, right?
Uh-huh.
Is how do you just send photons around for fun? So that's what this campus is amazing at doing. And so one of the things that's been great is that the photonics crew has gotten on board with the brain thing and said, yeah, we can make, if you need those lasers, we can make them smaller, we can make them cheaper so that everyone can use them and everyone can start figuring out, you know, how are these things actually working. So we're really excited that that's a new project that's got underway it's led by one of our new investigators, Spencer Smith, and he's put together this fantastic consortium of people to say, yeah, let's make this thing better and cheaper and easier to use and then hand it out to everyone. And now we'll have like a new field where people can be exploring what brains are doing in a totally different way.
What are some of the practical implications of this? For example, will your research being used to heal people from illness and injury, that kind of thing?
I hope so. I think at this point, one of our specialties, so we definitely, one of the projects that is very close to my heart is with a number of our, my mechanical engineering colleagues. So when I first got to this campus, I had met Professor Kimberly Foster, and she makes machines, microelectrical mechanical machines that are smaller than the width of a human hair. That's her specialty.
Nanotechnology.
Yeah, nano and microscale technologies, exactly. And so she had said, you know, I just made the world's tiniest, like, hammer and anvil,
wow.
Right? And what should I do with it? And we were kind of scheming. And so it's the world's tiniest hammer and anvil, and she can actuate it, like, thousands of times a second, billions of times without any failure. I mean, this is a really accurate, reliable device that she's made. And so one of the things that we said was, okay, we've now gotten to the point, unlike in the 90s, where people do believe that concussions and traumatic brain injury are a serious problem afflicting our athletes, afflicting our veterans. You know, it's not just some made-up symptom. It's that the impact on your head has, you know, has done something bad, and how are we going to fix it? And one of the problems is, if you look at a human brain, I mean, there's hundreds of billions of cells, and so, like, that impact could do anything. You know, it's like, which cells did it injure, and is it a genetic change, or was it a chemical change, or are there electrical fire? I mean, there's just an infinite number of possibilities as to what could have gone wrong, and that's one of the things that's been really holding back interventions for concussions, is like just narrowing down from all of the things that could go wrong, which are the ones that are most wrong. And obviously, it's not ethical to do those studies. You're not going to just take two, you're not going to take twins and give one of them a head injury. So
right.
It's like, it's been very, very hard to pinpoint the cause. And so what we decided was, okay, well, you have this thing. You know, we're not doing it with humans right now, but we can take cells, or we could take stem cells, and we could flow them through this thing, and we could hit them with kind of repeatedly or once small, medium, large forces, and then we will have tens of thousands and millions of repetitions of exactly the same experiment to be able to say, okay, if we take this type of neuron, this type of cell, and we give it one small force or a small force every day for, you know, a month, or one large force, we can do all of these experiments to say, okay, what is the first thing that happens? Is it the membrane that changes, or are there DNA changes? Or, you know, and so we can now have this very high-throughput approach to say, guys, we have to narrow it down. We have to figure out what is happening first, second, and third, which are the changes which could be reversed, which are the ones where this is a point of no return once you see this happen. We got to give up on those cells. So it sounds like kind of sci-fi, but I think we will really be able to make a lot of headway in kind of narrowing down the hypotheses and saying, guys, these cells are very sensitive. These ones can come back. These are the ones we got to protect. These are the ones that are vulnerable. These are the guys who can recover. And hopefully, also, we can see what the physical change in the cells are, so then we can say, okay, if this is what's changing, we know how to fix that. So it seems a long way off, but I think that it really is going to create an opportunity to launch the field in the right direction.
And one thing I'm thinking in particular is redundancy, what I would call redundancy. Your language center is damaged in your left hemisphere. I've read studies where if the conditions are right, you can duplicate that. And I think it's Wernicke's area or something in the right hemisphere. And another part of the brain will take over a function for a part that was damaged, and pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah, exactly. The brain is very plastic. And so I think it's important to say, what are the things that, you know, we could recover from? Again, it's sort of, I mean, it's the equivalent, what we were talking about, the justice system, is to say, okay, what are the conditions where we can rehabilitate here, and we can get this person back on their feet, or we could get this brain area back on their feet? And what are the situations where we say, okay, you know, this brain area is really messed up, and we're going to have to come up with a different, maybe technological solution to help this person out?
Understood. Any final thoughts, as we're just about out of time?
One of the hard things about science is every time it solves a problem, the problem is solved, and then we move on to the next problem. And so we no longer see the problems that we used to have, right? So like I said, we didn't used to care about Alzheimer's because we were caring about tuberculosis. Tuberculosis is what was killing us. And no one thought we were going to be able to get past those diseases. I mean, they were actual plagues.
Right.
What I would like people to trust is that the most insurmountable problems of the day will be surmounted. And the best way that we know in history to surmount them is through science and technology. Robert Boyle, who's one of the first kind of major chemists, he had written a wish list about 300 years ago of the problems that he wished could be solved. And if you look back at it now, all of them have been solved. And so, yes, you could say, well, we don't have 300 years. But not all of them took 300 years. But it's just to say, if you want us going in the right direction, this is the best thing that we have to say, let's figure it out. We'll figure it out together. We'll make the world better.
This has been Brian Reynolds, volunteer with the San Luis Obispo County Library, for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we were joined by Dr. Bridget Queenan, Associate Director of the University of California Santa Barbara Brain Initiative. Thank you, Dr. Queenan.
Thanks, Brian.